Hey everybody, it's me, Dr. Smith, and this is my lecture for East Asian Politics at the University of Virginia's College at Wise on the key institutions and structures you need to understand to have at least a basic grasp on the Japanese state and political system at the national level. Understanding, of course, that we're limited in terms of how much we can actually talk about on this in this format. Remember that your readings are really critical, more so now than even ever before, and to keep up with those. So to understand the Japanese state, one of the things that's really important to bear in mind is when I talk about it, I'm going to be talking about the state as it exists after the reforms of the 1990s and early 21st century. The Japanese state prior to that had basically had essentially the same constitutional design since the version that was developed in association with the occupying American forces in the 1940s. Basically, this constitutional design was, in many ways, it was very innovative. It's very interesting. It's worth reading the Constitution. It's briefer than a lot of newer democracy constitutions. But it underwent some reforms basically because the Japanese system had experienced two kind of major phenomena. I mean, granted, the Japanese Constitution as written and promulgated basically in 47 had been very successful at seeing a Japan that had totally revitalized after the Second World War and that had seen the development of a liberal political economic culture that was fairly dynamic. But other things had transpired at the same time. One is that one party had come to utterly dominate the Japanese system, the Liberal Democratic Party, the LDP as we normally call it. And for most of its history, the Japanese state had been completely dominated by the LDP. This was tolerated for a long time, in part because the LDP was very successful at gaining economic development and seeing consistent development in the Japanese state and the Japanese economy. The other thing, reason is honestly because of the Cold War. The LDP was a sure bet that it was anti-communist, it was anti-Soviet, that it kept the Americans content and happy. With the 1990s, both those reasons for tolerating the high levels of corruption that were necessary, as is always necessary to keep one party in power for an extremely long period of time. Maybe not always, but pretty darn close to always. Basically, those pressures to tolerate the corruption of the LDP, the extensive kind of patronage systems that it had to develop, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. All those pressures to tolerate those, just like they did in, say, Italy and some other countries before the tension to Poli, basically they kind of evaporate. The Asian financial crisis begins in the 90s, and we see that the Japanese have the so-called lost decade, in which GDP growth is essentially flat or negative most years. It's the Japanese have a high level of dissatisfaction with their state's response to this crisis. And then you have all the existing dissatisfaction with the Japanese state and the high levels of patronage and corruption that we've seen basically for decades. And all this ultimately leads, very predictably, I think, to the emergence of the of a series of reforms in the 90s and the early 21st century intended to try to make it more difficult for one party to come to dominate the Japanese state for any real length of time. Basically to make elections more competitive, control of the state by different parties more a functional truth. So when we talk about the design of the Japanese system, that's it's the post-reform designs that we're talking about. So, right off the bat, we have in Japan a legislature that we normally refer to as the National Diet, the Kokai. I apologize for my Japanese pronunciations. I apologize for my English pronunciations. The Kokai is a bicameral legislature. The upper house is the House of Counselors, the Sankeien. which has 242 members, and its head of parliamentary procedure is a president, you know, in the literal sense of the word, someone who presides, right? The House of Representatives is the lower house, the Shugian, which has 465 seats, currently, at least, and is basically, the head of parliamentary procedure is a speaker who also is backed up by a vice speaker, and then is also, the lower house is responsible for the election of the head of government, the prime minister. It should be said that Japan is a dual executive system, but it is a, you know, a British-style dual executive as opposed to some styles that have like a prime minister or premier as well as a president. It has, of course, a head of government who is a ceremonial head of government, the emperor, who has no law administering or law and acting powers that are distinct and definitively unto himself anymore, certainly. Basically, let's talk about the House of Representatives first, the lower house, 465 seats, we pointed out. Now, what's interesting is they're elected in two different ways. On the one hand, 289 of these are elected in first-past-the-post elections. And what, of course, that implies is that the elections are carried out by literally whoever gets the most votes, or the plurality of votes within a district wins. And these are scattered around the entire country. They're nationally distributed, so 289 different districts. 176 seats, however, are elected through party list proportional constituencies, basically. So we have a constituency in which there is a proportional election. The proportional election is, in essence, a one in which we see that there's a list of people that you're voting from, and so you can feel confident not only in terms of if your party gets, say, let's say it's a three-person constituency. If your party gets two-thirds of the seats, you know exactly who the two people who will be put into the legislature will be. If it gets three, you know exactly who the three will be, or one, of course, one. So it's a kind of classical party list system, which is intended, of course, to have all the benefits of proportionality, that is to say, bringing in second, third, fourth, fifth parties into parliament, well, probably third, fourth, fifth parties, I mean, second, you would assume, in a classical first-past-the-post. But with the additional benefit of first-past-the-post, of course, allows you to vote not just for parties, but allows you to vote for individuals, to vote on either kind of preference structure is what you get with the party list proportional. So nothing too dramatically fancy there. Terms are four-year terms in the House of Representatives, and there is a principle of dissolution available. The House can either be dissolved by the Prime Minister, or if there is a passage of a vote of no confidence in the government, then you have a parallel dissolution in the House of Representatives. So a fairly typical kind of parliamentary structure in that regard. Now, what makes the House of Representatives kind of particularly interesting to me is that if a bill is passed in the House of Representatives but voted down by the House of Counselors, which we're going to talk about its institutional design in a little bit, then there is an override, but the override is a significant override. It's a two-thirds override. So it's a supermajority override, which is a powerful override rule. Makes it really difficult to get overrided. Now, there are some exceptions. The key exceptions, and I think this is super-duper important, is if the House of Representatives passes a bill that is either a treaty, it is a budget, or it is a bill for the selection of a prime minister, then the failure to vote in concurrence with that is really just a delaying vote. So let's say we're trying to pass a treaty. Let's use that as our example. And the treaty is passed in the House of Representatives. The House of Counselors votes against the treaty. All that the House of Representatives is going to have to do is wait for a short period of time, vote on it again, and again a simple majority will pass the treaty. On the other hand, if we look at the House of, or on basically a normal bill, and the House of Counselors passes it, or House of Representatives pass it, the House of Counselors then approach the bill and they decide not to pass it, then for the House of Counselors to vote that regular bill into law, it requires the two-thirds vote override of a supermajority. So again, those categories that are the exceptions are treaties, budgets, and the selection of a prime minister. So basically the establishment of a government. This is interesting to me because it is, you know, in many ways it seems fairly parallel to the American system, you know, with the supermajority override. But these big exceptions have a couple effects. One is, I mean, obviously it's a logical exception because if you don't have a prime minister, then you can't put, you don't have a government, your ability to actually do governmental business is essentially zero under those conditions. The budget's also important because, like having a government, it's absolutely necessary for the actual day-to-day running of the government. Treaties are also interesting because we do see kind of this kind of appropriation of the power, the ultimate power of a treaty, to one house in the United States, right? But it is not the House of Representatives. On the other hand, it is the Senate. It is the more professional, more formalistic, smaller house that has that power. So this is, to a substantial degree, kind of inverted that characteristic, which is, it's not difficult to explain. It is quite a different logic, right? Why did we give the power to approve or fail to approve treaties, to ratify or fail to ratify, I should say, I suppose, to the Senate in the United States? Well, ultimately, because the Senate was regarded as the less political of the houses. It was the less concerned with immediate political consequences. On the other hand, here we have, in Japan, the more definitively political houses given this. Why? Probably because it's an emphasis on democracy, right? It is an attempt to say, we have decided we value democracy more than apoliticism or more than even legislative professionalism. Why might that be the case? Well, probably, if I were going to guess, it would be because Japan was recently an authoritarian state and an aggressive one. And so by giving this power to the lower house, you theoretically at least are going to make it less likely that Japan will engage in militarist adventurism. So that's a notion. On the other hand, when we look at the House of Counselors, we see some other kind of key differences. So there's 245 members who serve in six-year terms. These six-year terms are staggered in their elections. So every 3 years, half of the House of Counselors stands for re-election. This is in contrast, of course, to the United States, where in our Senate, our upper house, one-third stands every 2 years for election. So the 245 members, they have six-year terms. There is no dissolution in the House of Counselors as well, which makes sense given that this is not the House responsible for the selection of the Prime Minister in a definitive sense. Like, get a vote, but the vote can be simply overrun by just a revote in the House of Representatives. Now, the houses in the House of Counselors are also, are the houses, oy vey. The members of the House of Counselors are elected in two different ways. 147 members of the House of Counselors are elected by a single non-transferable vote, and 98 are voted by party list proportionalism. Now, the party list proportional guys, let's talk about them first, are done on a national scale. So they're not done in prefectures, they're done nationally. So that's a very kind of interesting thing. It means I guess your party would have to have 98, well, not have to, but if you had any sense that there was a possibility you could win the majority of all of the votes, then you'd have to have 98 people on your list. I doubt that it's ever been, I don't doubt it. I know that no one's ever managed to achieve 100%. That's a good sign that your democracy is failing. Single non-transferable votes basically are multi-member constituencies. So you have a constituency that is going to have more than one person elected from it, but you only get to vote for one person. And then the top vote getters in that constituency will be elected to the House of Councilors. So what does this mean? Well, it means that representing you will be at least one member from a party you just don't want elected. It's not your first choice, maybe not even your second choice. It's just going to be, you get to vote for who you want to, but you can be assured that the opinions of different ideological groups are going to be heard in the House of Councilors, because they're just going to be guaranteed to have multi-party election, or multiple parties representing pretty much any given constituency. Let's see, what else do we have here? Those are the broad strokes. I mean, again, the legislative design is fairly straightforward in the Japanese parliament. That said, there's some other things we need to know before we completely move on from the legislature. Actually, a fair number of them. One is that when we look at the committee structure of the legislature, both houses do have standing committees and special committees. Standing committees are just like in any country's legislature, you would expect. They do the business of reviewing most regular kinds of general legislative topics. We also see that people, or special committees are created for special purposes, especially to respond to particular, shall we say, singular events or needs. There are also research committees, which are empowered to research different policy areas or specific needs. But research committees are not empowered to specifically examine or consider bills. So you can almost think of them as like a subgenre of special committee that is theoretically supposed to be a little more neutral and aloof. Though one would assume that a research committee's findings will influence future standing and special committee decisions. The committees are also, it should be noted, there are some kind of rather interesting, distinctly Japanese structures that tend to govern how committees function. One of these are zoku, or policy tribes. Zoku is spelled Z-O-K-U. Policy tribes basically are diet members who tend to specialize in very specific sorts of work, very specific sorts of subject or field areas. Normally, these zoku are correlated with particular interest groups. So if you're from a part of Japan, you represent a district that has energy production is particularly important, you're going to want to be in a zoku that deals with energy production. If you're from a rural Japanese area, you probably want to be in an agriculturally oriented, and so forth. So it is, in essence, this is an instrument of factionalization in Japan. It also feeds patronage and patronage systems in Japan, as you might imagine, and was particularly significant back in the LDP days, but it's still important today. And there are clear analogs in the United States. If we look at people who have been in the legislature for a long time in the United States, one of their principal goals is to get into particular committees or sets of committees that give them access to influence over policies that their constituents are particularly interested in, that give them the ability to influence perhaps pork barreling to the benefit of their constituents. None of this is particularly unusual or surprising. It should be said, though, the Zoku of Japan are considered particularly robust. They're very durable. They have been around for a while, and they don't seem to be going anywhere. But again, not that wildly unusual from my perspective. The other thing that we see is that in Japan, we have what are called Kaiha politics. K-A-I-H-A. And Kaiha politics are basically caucuses within parties. Even though the parties have basically fractured, and if you look up the parties currently in the Japanese legislature, you'll see there's quite a few of them. There's a plethora. Within these parties, particularly the larger parties like the LDP, there are factions or caucuses that will work together in order to guarantee that they have access to particular committees. In other words, you can think of the caucuses interact with the Zoku to guarantee particular patronage benefits to particular caucuses. What's really interesting in this is that the Kaiha are basically kind of functionally institutionalized. They are, you pretty much have to be a member of a caucus in order to do some of the most important things. And the caucus, not just any caucus, but a caucus with at least 20 other members. So to propose a bill, you have to be a member of a Kaiha that has at least 20 members. And to propose a budget, you would have to be a member of a caucus that has at least 50 members. This is kind of interesting. But the power of your caucus, the relative power of your caucus is going to determine not only how many people from that caucus get onto committees, but as part, and we'll talk about the committee membership just in a second, but also the how much time does your caucus have during the periods of questioning on bills and to the prime minister. And of course, it even can affect like how much of a legislative budget you have for research and travel. So your caucus membership is quite important in the Japanese system. Now, let's go back to that just a second. Committee membership, how is it allocated? Well, each committee is guaranteed to be divided up according to the relative power or strength, if you will, of each party or each party coalition in the Japanese parliament, in that house in question, right? So what you have then is at one level, contention for control over committees is a party question, but within the parties, there is another game. There's another level of competition, and that is within and between caucuses for control of party allocation of spoils, if you will, for getting control over a substantial portion of parliament. So that's, I believe, that's those are the normal committee kind of stuff. There's some other kind of special committees that are worth noting. One is we have joint committees. Joint committees, the most important joint committees in the Japanese system, we have a judge indictment committee and a judge impeachment committee. So for a judge to be removed from office by the parliament, they first are heard by the judge indictment committee, and then they could be removed from office if the judge indictment committee decides to actually level a charge, reasoning that it's worthy of them being removed from office. The actual trial is heard by the judge impeachment committee. Interestingly, both of these committees are joint committees. They are made up by members from both house. And I find this interesting because what it does is it makes it, I would argue, institutionally speaking, much more simple and straightforward to remove a potentially bad faith judge from office than having the kind of impeachment processes that you see in countries like the United States, where it requires super majorities of both houses. So it's much more likely to be used, for better or for worse. We also have conference committees in the Japanese system. And when a bill is passed in both houses that are coincidental but are not precisely the same, in other words, they're close but they're just not there yet, then a conference committee is formed in an effort to try to develop a bill that will be satisfactory to both houses, that has, of course, members of both houses, presumably from appropriate zoku. These conference committees are going to be their success level is going to ultimately depend on the ability to produce something that's satisfactory to both houses. Nothing crazy there, nothing unusual, functions just like in the United States. Again, of course, we don't forget that in the Japanese system, you do not have to have, for certain subject areas, concurrence by both houses. So if a conference committee fails on the question of prime minister choice, of a treaty, or of the budget, it doesn't really matter, it just gets repassed again in the House of Representatives. Otherwise, for the House of Representatives to pass a bill, if a satisfactory conference halfway ground isn't found, a mediated outcome isn't developed that's satisfactory, then it's going to require a two-thirds override from the House of Representatives. All right, that leaves us with two other institutions that are found, one of each in both houses. One, we have the Secretariat. There's a Secretariat in both houses. And these are basically professionals, they're bureaucrats whose principal job is to help with clerical questions and research. They're there to basically assist the work of the legislators. We also have a legislative bureau in each house. And their whole purpose, their whole reason for being is to help draft bills. So it is specifically something that is aimed at making sure we have uniform, they're professionals whose whole goal is to be like, well, we want to make sure these bills actually fit within the logic and the construction of our existing bureaucratic system. Let's see, I think that's everything I want to say on that. All right, there's one other thing I do want to add before we move on to talk about the judiciary of Japan or anything like that. And it's not insignificant, but it's really a point of ambiguity. I haven't been able to confirm what proportion of the bills in Japan are actually submitted by the government as opposed to simply emerge from non-governmental members of parliament. I just haven't been able to find statistics on that. I checked my books, I've checked online. I'm going to keep looking. If I find something, I'll post it to the Moodle page, guys. But I'm just not 100% certain about any of that. So, as to that, I'm just not 100% sure. The government can, of course, submit bills, but the bills still have to go through the complete committee consideration and voting process. So the government has no specifically unique legal empowerment to pass bills. And the other thing, of course, is we'll see the government is made up of members of parliament. It's a parliamentary fed cabinet. So in and of itself, that's not particularly dramatic or exciting. So if I can find those statistics, I'll get them to you. One of the dilemmas, I'm sorry, I don't know why I wasn't able to find those as I put this together. So, anyways, the judiciary, all right. The Japanese judiciary is fairly straightforward. We can think of it as, generically speaking, it is a four-layer court in which the vast majority of cases are heard in either summary courts or district courts. There's 438 summary courts. There are 50 district courts with 20 additional branches. And these are the smaller courts that by and large hear the vast majority of minor cases, minor civil, minor criminal cases. The more significant it is, the more likely it is to be in a district court. So they are like courts of first appeal. And the summary courts are specifically populated by end-of-career judges. Judges who are just kind of near the end of things, and it's just a place for them to have slightly easier workloads, frankly, which I find very interesting. It's a little different than how we tend to think of it in the United States. We also have a high court system with 8 courts that is basically the equivalent of our circuit court or appeals courts, and then we have a Supreme Court in Japan. So these are our kind of fundamental broad strokes. We'll come back and touch on each of those a little bit. So let's start out actually with the Supreme Court, just because it's honestly going to be the one that we talk about the most. It's just the one most interesting. Okay, I double checked. I wanted to make sure I got this right. So the Supreme Court justices stand for retention re-election or retention referendum, pardon me, every 10 years. So I also double checked, and the average Supreme Court justice in Japan isn't appointed until the age of 64. So virtually none of them, only a small proportion actually even ever stand for appointment. And then if they stand for appointment, literally so far, no one has actually been removed based on this referendum. So it's I'm not going to say it's a moot point, but it's also maybe not as sharp a teeth in terms of referendum and democracy on the march as you might imagine. Now, the way that the Supreme Court functions is it has we can regard it as having a grand bench and 3 petty benches. The grand bench is basically a meeting of all 15 justices, including the Chief Justice. But petty benches, which are made up of 5 justices at a time, I believe, are basically, they exist to hear arguments on whether or not a case should be considered by the grand bench. So basically they're a way of making sure that only cases that have adequate merit actually get heard by the Supreme Court in a substantive way. Now, what is really interesting about the Supreme Court is it is the only court in Japan, literally the only court, that has judicial review. So it's unlike the United States, where our circuit courts also engage in judicial review. The Supreme Court of Japan also is engaged in that process. Now, below that, of course, we have the high courts, the courts of next to final appeal, I suppose. There are 8 of those. Now, I did say there were 8 before. I should have also added, there are also 6 branches of the high courts, of these appeals courts. And these 6 branches do not include yet an additional that is like ranked at the same level, an intellectual property high court. And they're located in major metropolitan areas. And in essence, they're exactly what they sound like. They're appeals courts. There's nothing particularly unusual about that other than the intellectual property court, which is just a specialized appeals court, or for something of adequate significance could be a court of first appeal. And these appeals courts are, they engage in hearings with 3 justices sitting, 3 judges sit on any given appeals court. The district courts are basically, they're where the majority of courts of first instance occur. They're minor cases. Again, they have 3 judge panels. If they're major, the more significant the case is, the more likely they are to have 3 justices. Otherwise, if it's a very, very minor case over minor criminal or civil issues, there's probably only going to be 1 judge sitting. Otherwise, district courts are going to have it. You're going to have a single judge as opposed to a 3 judge panel. But it's either one or the other. They also hear appeals from the summary courts and from the various family courts in Japan, which I didn't even bring up because there's really not much written on it in English that I've found. There probably is. There probably is quite a bit. But it's not a literature that I'm familiar with, is maybe a better way to put it. Now, all that said, if you're familiar with the American court system, so far, the thing that probably stands out to you the most, other than the fact that you have the petty benches on the Supreme Court, and you have the retention referendums for the Supreme Court. Those probably stand out to you as pretty darn interesting if you're an Americanist or an American kind of looking at these. Other than that, I think what's very important is to bear in mind that the Japanese system, of course, not based on the English tradition of law. And there is traditionally no use of juries whatsoever in Japanese legal system. What has emerged since and in recent years, literally just since reforms in 2009, is you've begun to see an attempt to create a system of lay judges. That is to say, people who aren't professional law persons but are trained, and they work basically with panels of three professional judges on certain types of very, very serious questions, very, very serious cases. So that's kind of an interesting thing. But otherwise, there's no juries in the Japanese system. It is a system in which the decisions are made by judges who are also involved in the process of trying to determine. They're not merely referees in the United States, as in the United States, but like in, say, Napoleonic systems, they're engaged in the process of trying to uncover the truth and cross-examine and so forth. So, the Japanese system, it should be noted as well, is also founded ultimately on six different codes of law, which I find very interesting. The national Japanese system is, it has got a civil code of law, which is particularly influenced by German and French law. That's really what it was built on, so that makes sense that we would have a non-jury based system. And also, there in Japan, we see there is a commercial code of law, a criminal code of law. The Constitution is regarded as a code of law. We also have a code of law each for criminal procedure and civil procedure. And while there is some consideration of judicial precedent in Japan, judges are allowed to consider judicial precedent, there is not specifically a, how do I put it? You wouldn't regard it as binding. So judges have the right to consult it, but don't necessarily have to abide by it, is maybe the basic way to put it. Okay. Awesome. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the Japanese government, the quote-unquote executive branch, very much, because it's pretty self-explanatory. I mean, it's a parliamentary system in which the members of the government basically are derived from the ruling party or ruling coalition in proportion to their importance in that coalition. And are assumedly are also allocated according to the caucus power of those within those parties. They function in a way that's pretty typical of most parliamentary style governments, in which the head of a committee is, the member of the cabinet is both a member of this, basically the committee that is the cabinet, but also is in charge of a ministry in the Japanese system. So nothing really too extraordinary there. It's pretty much what you would expect from any parliamentary system in the broad strokes constitutionally. So the governor, it should be said, from what I have read, the prime minister does have the ability to basically remove particular members from, once they're appointed, they can remove them later on. Though this can often cause crises, especially if they're someone from another party. So, now let's speak a little bit on the overall kind of institutional structure of Japan. The Japanese system is a unitary state. Now, remember what this means. Unitary, let's contrast it with a federation and a confederation. In a confederal state, the political system is one in which the localities, let's call them provinces. The provinces retain the bulk of the sovereignty. The central government sovereignty is highly defined, highly limited. It's restricted. And it largely exists to coordinate provinces and to allow them to better negotiate internationally. In a unitary state, the central government retains all of the sovereignty, and the provincial systems, they have no effective sovereignty. They exist pretty much just as administrative organs. And so on the local level, democracy is, if it is a democratic system that's unitary, is sometimes a little bit problematic because the domination of the central government is so high. And one of the major goals of a lot of states that are unitary has been over the last like 60 years to try to figure out how do you remain unitary but also guarantee the democratic impulse at the local and provincial level. And it's kind of a quandary. And in between those are states that are federations. And federations, of course, are political systems in which there has been a rough attempt to give approximately equal sovereignty, equal responsibility to both the central government and to the provincial governments. And of course, the United States, in many ways, kind of invented that system when we were trying to find a solution for how did we want to run our affairs after the British experience, in which what we kind of saw was we came to the determination that ultimately the British system did not guarantee our localities, our provinces, our subnational units adequate protection of their legislative rights and imperatives, and in fact. And towards the middle and the end of the post, say, French and Indian period, the British Parliament was trying to wrest control over laws and over the ability to generate taxes and so forth, completely from those parliaments, those provincial parliaments of the various American colonies. And so we devised, in essence, what we think of as federalism or the federation, as a kind of attempt to achieve the strong central government of Britain that is very capable of dealing with international crises in particular, but also of coordinating things like your economy and so forth, but also to guarantee meaningful sovereignty within subunits, within provinces. So it's an attempt to achieve a happy medium. I won't speculate as to how successful it is or isn't. That's kind of up to different philosophical perspectives, and we can debate that if you want sometime. All right. So how is the subnational government of Japan arranged, where we have 47 prefectures or general kind of administrative divisions? But those, what we call prefectures, technically actually come in what we might call four different categories. 43 of these are just good old-fashioned, regular, generic prefectures. And prefecture is just really like the equivalent of a province or what have you. Two of these are urban prefectures. That is to say, they are particularly large metropolitan areas, and their status is therefore kind of distinguished. And that's Osaka and Kyoto. One is a circuit prefecture, which is a very large area. It's relative to the others. It is the most rural of the prefectures. And unsurprisingly, if you're familiar at all with Japan, as you should be from the readings, that's Hokkaido, right? And we talked about Hokkaido quite a bit, actually, in the historical buildup of things. So, and that's a circuit prefecture. And then finally, we have one prefecture called basically a metropolis prefecture, which is Tokyo. And so ultimately, none of this should be too crazily surprising because ultimately they're just not that different. They're different titles or different names for political organizations that are not really in control of their destiny. Some authors have called, what is the phrase they use? 30% autonomy as kind of the standard that's generally understood in Japan, which is way less than in most developed countries. So the prefectures are, even though they come in different types, they all kind of function very similarly. some of these prefectures, if they're either very large in area or they have very, very high populations, are subdivided into sub-prefectures as a way of trying to, again, deal with the complications of organization. And all of them also have districts, which are roughly equivalent to our counties. But the difference is while districts still exist and they're used for different kinds of symbolic reasons, by and large, they're irrelevant. And the reason they're irrelevant shouldn't surprise us. If we look in the United States, our counties are an attempt to make sure there was an arm of government that was relatively accessible to anyone, right? No matter where they were in space within the United States. Our counties now, in the age of mass communication and mass transportation, are increasingly kind of irrational historical organizations. They make sense culturally, but they don't necessarily make sense in terms of effective oversight. And you do have calls in the United States to get rid of counties. And in fact, a former governor of West Virginia argued for that. So, and I think that there's maybe not everywhere in the United States, maybe not even in every part, like in some states it should be done different ways, but I think there's good arguments to be made that counties are increasingly archaic institutional systems. So there are also 1,742 municipalities in Japan. These municipalities include cities, towns, villages, and the various wards, which are subdivisions of Tokyo. Think of them kind of like boroughs in New York. So they come in every size and shape, and ultimately, though, they do the same kinds of direct interaction government that you would see in a municipality in the United States, or frankly, in a county, a rural county in the United States. So they are where probably the vast majority of actual governmental process gets done. The actual administration of government takes place largely in these areas. A couple other points remain that I want to make sure we get down so that we feel like we've got a good basic broad stroke rule. Actually, one in particular is this concept of giri ninjo. Giri ninjo is basically, it's a phrase that's kind of like, the two words don't necessarily have to, you can talk about giri or you can talk about ninjo. So on the one hand, giri means kind of social obligation or duty. And ninjo basically refers to this concept of like emotion and compassion. And the two are understood as being in a permanent tension with each other in Japanese politics. So we've talked a lot about how there are these kind of built-in tensions in Japan, in no small part because the Japanese system contrasts and conflates and has this interaction of rationalist Confucian bureaucratism based on very, very specific philosophical tenets. And then we can contrast that with the hierarchism and the nobility orientation, if you will, of the Japanese feudal system. Both of these, of course, have an impact, as you might imagine, on the way in which the Japanese conceptualize superior-inferior relationships. And you have this quandary of, do you do what is right, what you believe to be right, what you believe to be what the people want sometimes as well, or do you fulfill your responsibilities to your political superiors? Which certainly is critical in understanding the kind of patronage politics that we see and that you've read about, of course, in your readings on Japan. This tension is not ever perfectly resolved, but if I were going to, I mean, my gut instinct is to say the dominant of these until the 90s was giri, but that tension has always been, that unresolved tension has actually got the potential to be a real creative force in Japanese politics. Well, guys, this has been a super-duper, ultra-fast introduction to the Japanese political state. Just trying to get you the broad strokes so that when you look at the readings, you've got this. Those two together should at least give you, if not everything you need to know, then at least the ability to say, all right, now I know what I need to ask Dr. Smith about. What is something that I don't understand either from the readings or from the lecture? You can contact me. If needs be, I'll even make another lecture just on that subject, even if it's really short. If it's 5 minutes, that's fine. Or I'll just explain it to you in direct contact. Guys, I hope you're doing okay. I hope you're keeping safe. And I will talk to you soon. Be safe.